I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. New Hampshire's rude rebuff of George W. Bush has given the rest of the world time for a second look at him. The second impressions have gone different ways. On the eve of the South Carolina primary tomorrow, Governor Bush seems in the polls to have consolidated his grip on the loyal regular Republicans. It's the crossover Democrats and independents who could still tip the victory to Senator John McCain. From the critical sidelines, Lars Eric Nelson of the New York Daily News writes, George Bush's biggest vulnerability as he seeks the White House is that the more you look at him, the less you see. We're taking our own look this hour, Connection listeners, at the hero-worshipping son of former President George H.W. Bush. Little George, or Junior as the family has called him, grew up in awe of his father's war record, his father's oil field success, his father's drive in public and political life. But who is George W. on his own, people have a right to ask, beyond being the first son of the Big Bush Network? We're joined by his biographer, Elizabeth Mitchell, author of W, Revenge of the Bush Dynasty, and by Wayne Slater, who's covered George W. Bush in Texas and on the presidential trail for the Dallas Morning News. Elizabeth Mitchell is in New York, Wayne Schroeder's in Texas. Nick Lemon of The New Yorker will join us after the break. Connection listeners, do you know yet what we're looking at in George W. Bush? Is it revenge? Is it a restoration? Is it reform? Is it aristocracy? Make the Who Is W connection at 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Elizabeth Mitchell, could we start with you?
Yes.
We enjoy your book enormously.
Oh, thank you so much.
It seems to be all about Dad, with a great deal more, I have to say, love and loyalty and deep admiration, as well as perhaps intimidation, than I had realized. How does he measure up?
Well, he doesn't measure up as well as his father in terms of the standard forms of achievement. For example, at Andover and Yale, that both men went to those schools, and he did not fare as well as his father either academically or athletically. there was the difference of his father being a war hero in World War II, whereas George W. Went into the Texas Air National Guard, which of course he's gotten a lot of criticism for in terms of taking the easy way out at that time. And then in the oil business, his father hit oil with 147 of 147 wells, where George W. only hit half and actually was weathering an oil boom, an oil bust at the time. So he never fared that well in those respects, but then he was, he actually, to a certain extent, had been a better politician. I mean, in Texas, he was just beloved, and, you know, has been in terms of the incredible turnout, the incredible victory he had over Gary Morrow, for example, in the last election. He was better as a grassroots politician, and, you know, perhaps that's what George Bush the father cared about most, so he might have beaten him in that one realm.
You know, could we talk a little bit about the money here?
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to sort of forgive him on the Vietnam thing. I mean, nobody flew off from Andover to Vietnam the way George H.W. Bush flew off to the Pacific
exactly.
In the 40s. It would have been inconceivable. Furthermore, President Bush was the son of his father, too, and was very much the beneficiary. I mean, his father had gone to Yale. He got into the oil business on the strength of his father's network. So none of these comparisons are quite fair. But I would like you to explain how George W. Bush managed his so-called success in Texas, specifically how he worked with the old Bush network in limited partnerships in the oil business, with tax write-offs that, in effect, made him rich and didn't cost his backers much of anything, and then how he became head of the Texas Rangers. What kind of a venture that really was? Did he put the deal together, or was he just a sort of pretty front, again, for big Texas business.
Yeah, well, for with the Texas Rangers, he said at the press conference where they announced the deal that his group was purchasing the team, that it was his idea. He put the group together, and Eddie Childs, who is the former owner of the team, wanted to sell to him. Well, in my reporting, it turns out that none of those are true, that in fact it was this man, Bill DeWitt Jr.'s idea to buy the team, that Peter Ueberroth and various other figures, including Jerry Reinsdorf, helped put together the investor team. And then Eddie Childs did not want to sell to him, according to some court records. He really did want to sell it to this other friend of his. And so, anyhow, none of those are true. And what you find regularly is that George W. gets these incredible breaks because of who he is and the fact that he has this public... he's recognized publicly because of his father, but then people don't really criticize him too robustly about them because he's a very amiable guy, and so they find it hard, while acknowledging his privilege, to really go after him wholeheartedly.
I'd like to ask Wayne Slater to introduce us to the political George W. Bush. This is a life that was going nowhere, people have said, until he was 40 years old. He had tried and failed in a congressional race in 1978. And then, lo and behold, he took on Ann Richards, the woman who taunted President Bush as the man who was born with a with his
silver foot
in his mouth. How did W. become so successful so quickly in Texas politics?
But he was the right guy at the right time. Demographically, the state was changing, like much of the South, so there were more Republicans voting Republican in this southern state. But two other things happened. One was that George Bush ran a very good campaign in 1994 against Ann Richards. He ran a disciplined campaign. He picked about four issues and pursued them, flogged them, said only stuff about those issues and nothing more.
What were they?
Well, basically, the four issues were tort reform, a business-minded issue that's very popular among the business community in Texas, and he's talking about it nationally, limiting lawsuits, juvenile justice, a welfare reform, and some changes in education, essentially some conservative changes in the education system. He talked about that, and he talked about nothing else. The other thing he did, and this will offend maybe some people, but he made a decision not to attack Ann Richards. Never to attack her, one, because it would look like that he thought that positive campaigns would run better. But more importantly, in the culture of Texas and in many states, if he were seen as attacking a woman, a political candidate, even someone as powerful and influential and as strong as Ann Richards, it would backfire. His campaign strategy worked. He beat her.
The moral of Elizabeth Mitchell's book is that you always have to wonder who he's fronting for. Was he fronting for anybody in the Texas governor's office?
Once he was in office?
Yeah, I want Wayne Slater to take a crack at that.
Well, I mean, the main person that he was fronting for actually seems to be Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock, who is now deceased but was the most powerful political force in recent Texas history. And he was more powerful than George W. And, in fact, many of those issues that Wayne was just referring to were off of Bob Bullock's dance card. I mean, he wanted to bring those to the legislature, so it matched up quite perfectly. So if anything, he was sort of following the path that Bullock laid down for him. But he doesn't have a very predictable pattern down in Texas, as far as my research found, of actually being kind of the mouthpiece of any particular industry. I mean, even the tort reform is very unpopular with lawyers, but now lawyers are backing him. He's got one of his biggest campaign contributions is from the legal community. So I would say it was more sort of strategically set up in terms of who he was speaking for, and that was, in a way,
Bullock. Wayne Slater, is he a force in his own right? What kind of a man is he in Texas politics?
You know, he is a delegator. he likes the big picture and not the detail. I've watched that from 1994 when he was running for office and when he became governor, and you see that in him now. He's a guy who basically likes to see a train that's moving, and he jumps on that train. Elizabeth is exactly right. Those issues that he campaigned on, those issues on which he was fairly successful in his first legislative session, were issues that were advocated by Bob Bullock, the lieutenant governor, and by Pete Laney, the House Speaker. So he sees an opening. The one real initiative, significant initiative, that he started on his own and promoted, a significant property tax cut in Texas, failed. So his record of successes, I guess the record is a function of understanding where the train is moving and getting on that train. And his one real initiative on his own was unsuccessful.
In the campaign 2000, the moving train was him.
Yeah.
I mean, he was what everybody was jumping on. The question about George W. Bush is, seems to be just very simply, you know, from, you know, starting from scratch, who is this man? If he weren't moving, and if he's not moving now, what is he?
Well, I mean, in terms of why he became such a popular candidate for 2000, it's partly that he's the anti-Bill Clinton, in as much as the whole family has this real fury about how Bill Clinton conducted himself in the White House. And so one of the main motivators when he was listening to all of these former advisors to his father and staffers and all the rest who were saying get in that race, it was that he knew that he had to go and try and make Clinton the Clinton administration a footnote in history. But in terms of the other reasons why he was attractive is that he is a very amiable guy, very charming. He's charmed even his opponents down in Texas. People, you know, all the governors and funders were coming down to Austin for these luncheons in the months preceding his announcement, and they were finding a man who was he's the governor of the second largest state, which is
all this is all the revenge and restoration drive. I mean, take that away.
I think the other main thing that motivates him is that his conversion or enlightenment, let's say, in 1985, when he was speaking to Reverend Billy Graham up in Kennebunkport, has significantly changed his life. It's part of what contributed to his giving up drinking, and it's what he sees. He knows that he's not a rocket scientist, but he does think that he has this kind of moral core that's based on his religious beliefs, and he needs to bring that out into America. And I think that that's a huge part of what motivates him.
I put that to Wayne Slater. I mean, he has said that the difference between making a fool of yourself in life and being a good governor is whiskey. Whiskey, giving up whiskey, accepting Jesus Christ, seemed to have been the definitive moment, you know, in his, late 30s, early 40s. Do you take it seriously, Wayne Slater?
As seriously as
he does?
I believe him. I've talked to him for years about this. He is, in a sense, a representation of what's happened to a lot of baby boomers, where they wake up, they have a family, and they begin to go back to church, or they take faith at a new level. And I think that's the kind of guy he is. He takes this very seriously, and yet he's a high church kind of guy, where he doesn't want to be showy. He doesn't want to be too ostentatious and too much like, you know, some of these, well, I shouldn't say, but he wants to be a religious person. He wants to be a person for whom faith is important. But he doesn't want to be someone like you see on these late-night television programs on the religious stations. Mm-hmm. So he's serious. He's very serious about this. And he's also very uneasy, and he has been until recently uneasy even talking about it for fear that it looks like that he's another religious huckster.
Mm. Could I ask you both, to me there's a real puzzle about George W. Bush as to whether he, you know, just his level of self-awareness. This is a man who doesn't credit his financial angels or his partners in baseball for putting him where he is. He's also a guy who goes through all the motions of mocking the privilege that made him. He's an anti-preppy. He's a self-hating Yaley. He's a child of the Eastern establishment who who pretends to revile it. This goes a lot further than his father's love of pork rinds and all those sort of Texas affectations. At least George Bush, the president, sounded, dressed, acted like a child of enormous privilege of the Greenwich Day School and that kind of thing. George W. seems deeply confused. I mean, he talks about the difference. He talks about going to public junior high school in Midland, but it was a momentary pause between private, in a long list of his private school education. Does he not know where he comes from?
Well, I think one of the things is that, you know, first of all, I was born in Connecticut, but I had the privilege of living for 6 months down in Texas when I was working on this book. And there is a very different way in which, for example, the success of people in Texas is perceived by their fellow citizens. For example, you know, one of the reasons I think George W. is so surprised out there in the primaries is because he's accustomed to the fact that in Texas, if you're doing well, it seems people kind of boost you up. They're happy to have somebody, you know, a favorite son who they're proud of. Whereas, you know, he's getting out into the political ring and realizing that, you know, he's got a lot more enemies to face. And so I think that what he was responding to in terms of emphasizing that whole tech, you know, his Texas background is he grew up there from the age of two until, 15, and then went back again for a good portion of his adulthood, and he found it a much more congenial place in which to be raised and to live.
Does he?
You know,
go ahead, Wayne.
Christopher, you know, I heard him this morning, and it's interesting because I listened to him, this disembodied voice on the radio this morning, an Elizabeth Arnold report, and I was struck by how Southern he sounded. Mm-hmm. In South Carolina. And I noticed that when we flew into South Carolina, he adopted this voice, which was a little more Southern. He knocked off the G's of the little more vigor. And he clearly is in his element in the South. That is who he is. He is not his father. And in many ways, Elizabeth has written a very good book that gets psychologically at some of the demons that are inside him. I think those are real. I think she's got it. But beyond that, this is a person who really authentically is a child in part of Texas. He never liked some of the snottiness, some of the arrogance, what he saw among the elite forces, the elite folks.
I just can't let him get away with that. He is the snottiness. He is the arrogance.
Of course, there's no question about that. He has grown up in a family of privilege, but he doesn't see that. You're right. He doesn't see that. He feels more comfortable, and he really does. When you go to his ranch in East Texas, to the lake, then he feels more comfortable there. When I talk to him as a person in Texas, he honestly feels that that's who he is, not a person from Connecticut. And really, although he understands the advantages of being from a family of privilege, he does not believe that is the reason that he has succeeded. He has succeeded, he believes, on his own merit.
Who is W is the question. And stand by, Elizabeth Mitchell will be back, but we've got to bring callers in. 1-800-423-8255. Do we know yet who George W. Bush is on his own? 1-800-423-TALK. Richard is on the line.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a question relative to all of this press we've heard, but there's a lot of smoke and heat, but very little light. George W. Bush apparently did cocaine or had alcohol issues or what have you. And his spin doctors, and he handled it about as poorly as anyone can. What's the truth of the story?
Elizabeth Mitchell.
Okay. Well, first of all, the only thing I would disagree with there is that they handled it as poorly as they could, because politically they handled it perfectly. They waited out public interest to the point where, you know, media polling was finding that voters just didn't care about the issue anymore, so it worked to his advantage that way. You know, I pursued the leads, as have all of these other publications, including, you know, the Wall Street Journal and all that. And what you find is you find a lot of people with who say that they have rumors of, you know, the fact that he used cocaine at one point, and they'll refer you to somebody who then turns out to not have direct information. It goes on and on that way. There's no, I was unable to find any definitive definitive proof that he did use cocaine.
I'd go further than that, Elizabeth. What you find is that cocaine use would seem to be implausible in any of his settings, not at Yale in the mid-60s, probably not in West Texas before or after. It doesn't...
Well, late in the at Yale, it definitely seems that that class of 1968, according to all concern, was one that just sort of was the last wave of kind of conservative college students, and right after that, it just turned into a kind of, you know, one graduate from George W.'s class said that he went back to law school in the fall of 69 and found that, you know, everybody was smoking pot and doing hallucinogens, and it was a real shock to him. And down in Texas, you know, it was conservative, much more conservative than the rest of the country at the in the early 70s. It's not completely implausible to me that he you know, used a drug along the way, but it clearly wasn't a very significant part of his life, because you'd have, first of all, more witnesses. You'd have more people complaining about its effects on his life. And the other thing is that I found over and over that he was actually very rigid in his public demeanor frequently, because he was so afraid of hurting his father's reputation. His father already was a public figure in Texas. So from the age of 18, he was out and he was a bit in the spotlight.
At the same time, he seems to even speak of himself as going through a longish period of borderline alcoholism.
Well, that definitely is true, that he was a heavy drinker. It was getting in the way of his being able to, you know, say, accomplish as much as he'd like, and it also was putting it was bringing out terrible things in his personality in public settings. There's one incident where he, for example, he cussed out Al Hunt, the Wall Street Journal reporter, who was dining with his four-year-old child and wife at a restaurant in Dallas, and he lit into him about this matter relating to his father, and it was because he was so lit up himself. So he apologized fairly recently for that. Another time he went up to a woman at a party during his drinking days and said, you know, how does it feel to have sex after 50, you know, and these sorts of things. So he had to stop drinking, according to his friends, so that he wouldn't actually cause any problems for himself or his father.
1-800-423-8255. Who is W on the eve of the South Carolina primary? 1-800-423-8255. Marty is on the line.
Chris.
Hello, Marty. Welcome.
Chris, a great show as usual. Chris, you've been talking about the George W.'s past and present in light of the fact that Bill Clinton has been always known as the comeback kid. George W. was humiliated in New Hampshire by a 19-point loss, and his firewall seems to be crumbling in South Carolina. What do your guests think, if he doesn't get the nomination, what do you think George Bush can do as far as coming back in politics?
If he doesn't get this nomination?
Yeah, if the thing kind of crumbles away, do you think he would be like Nixon, who reappears himself in a different image?
Wayne Slater.
Well, that's a really good question. We've really been focusing on what's going to happen tomorrow in South Carolina. You're really talking about what happens if he doesn't get the nomination at all. To be honest with you, if in fact he loses a nomination, say he loses South Carolina, loses Michigan, fails in California, loses the establishment support that he had, and John McCain becomes the nominee, he not only has lost, he becomes in a sense a kind of poster boy for what's wrong with modern day campaigns. And he risks becoming a kind of joke. The guy who not only was a candidate who ran a good race, but a candidate who ran a horrible race, who had every advantage, all the money, all the establishment, and in the year 2012, when political analysts talk about future candidates and future campaigns, they'll invoke the Bush experience as really an awful thing. I think if he doesn't win the nomination, he is not going to come back. I think, frankly, he would lose interest in coming back, and I think the experience would have poisoned the chances of him coming back.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting comment, both about American politics in general and about him. I mean, it's very interesting to see what people do after devastating setbacks. I mean, Ted Kennedy after Chappaquiddick, or Jimmy Carter after losing the presidency, or Elliot Richardson, say, after leaving the Nixon administration. I mean, these were men with, as it turned out, real lives to contribute. Does George W. Bush have that kind of character, do you think, Elizabeth Mitchell?
Well, I agree completely with Wayne that I think that that's exactly, he would go slinking off. The only thing, though, that would be interesting is that, you know, we were talking about that issue of timing and how George W. sees the correct timing to, you know, to jump into politics, or how to pick up issues to run on. And that's he cites that constantly throughout his life, and he saw it that way with 2000, that this was his moment. And there would never be another one, because he was running as an anti-Clinton candidate. And so he sort of recognized this might be his only shot. The only interesting thing is that when he got into the congressional race in 1978 in West Texas, that again was the timing. You know, it just was the coincidence of George Mahon retiring on George W.'s 31st birthday, when he was didn't have anything else to do but run. And so he lost that race, and then he stayed out of politics until all of a sudden Ann Richards, he sees some vulnerabilities in her as a manager of the state, and enough time had elapsed, you know, and obviously a congressional race in the West Texas doesn't influence public opinion quite as much as a failed presidential race. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see if, you know, 12 years down the line, George W. came back again, but it wouldn't be the next cycle for sure.
Well, you wonder. I mean, you wonder if this is an entirely sort of tactical approach to politics, even to life, a matter of moments, a matter of luck, a matter of accidents. We're talking about who is George W. Bush on the eve of the South Carolina primary with Elizabeth Mitchell, his biographer, and Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
From Boston University.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the W Connection. The question is, if you take all of George W. Bush's sort of starting advantages away, and New Hampshire pretty well did, what have you got? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 with Elizabeth Mitchell, who wrote the biography of George W. called W, Revenge of the Bush Dynasty, and Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News, who's covered him in Texas and in New Hampshire and elsewhere. We're joined by Nick Lemon of The Atlantic Magazine and The New Yorker. Nick Lemon, I think of you as the premier student of the American meritocracy. Lars Eric Nelson's piece in the New York Review of Books says Bush's spectacular career rebuts the notion that America has become a meritocracy. Or is he showing us how the meritocracy works?
Well, a little of both. It's a little more complicated than that. But let me first say that, you know, this is probably the most aristocratic presidential year in memory. America's a funny country. You know, we pride ourselves on being open to people from all over the place. Some presidents, such as Clinton or such as Reagan or such as Nixon, really come from a complete obscure background where they had no privilege, no money, no nothing. This year, Bush and McCain both come from family dynasties. Bush is son and grandson of prominent politicians. McCain is son and grandson of, I believe, grandson of Navy admirals, which
yep.
ain't chopped liver. Gore, of course, is the son of a U.S. senator. So we really have the race of the rich kids this year. Or not rich, but people who were born to
endowed, yeah.
And Bill Bradley, the outsider, is the son of a bank president. So none of these guys can get up and say, you know, I'm the log cabin president, and the opponents are not. Now, more particular to Bush, Bush was born into a particular American elite. which I somewhat jokingly have called the Episcopacy, that has faded. And he had to live through the fading of the elite that he was born into. It faded, and what rose in its place was a kind of more education-oriented elite, you know, the people who got high SAT scores and that kind of thing, which does not really describe him. So that accounts for the fact that on the one hand, you know, at every point, at every juncture, every detail of his life is about being born to privilege. There's almost nothing he's ever done that would have happened had he not been born to privilege. But on the other hand, I think he sincerely feels like he's not in the elite, and in fact he has a kind of populist resentment of the people he thinks of as being in the elite, with a high person on the list being Al Gore.
Yeah, explain that. We were talking about that before the break. How does a man live with all the advantages of this sort of episcopacy thrust upon him, and with this kind of walking, sneering contempt for what made him? I mean, that troubles me.
Well, you know...
Can he have it both ways?
A little bit. Life is complicated, and the way to understand elites in the United States, I think, is... You can't understand them as a kind of unitary thing. You can't say there is an elite in America. This country is too big and too complicated for that, and too fast changing. And what you have instead is elites succeeding each other and competing with each other.
I want to go back to his own head. He doesn't go out saying, I'm a child of privilege, and to whom much is given, much is required. Or I've learned a lot of things at the feet of my father about public life, public service, public strategies, diplomacy. He seems to say, I'm just a kind of dust kicker from West Texas.
I don't think that's what he really thinks. Here's what I think he really thinks. I mean, the Bushes are always saying, don't put me on the couch, and with apologies, I'm putting him on the couch now. I think inside his head, he knows he was born to privilege, and he's pretty good about never claiming that he made it all on his own. What he would think is, he would think, I was born into a group that are public servants. We don't, we think, you know, we were born with a lot of advantages, we have an obligation to serve the public. And so my motives are pure because they're just a desire to give back something to the society that's done so much for me. When he looks at Gore, he sees the elite thing to him means the people who, were kind of rising group at Yale, such as yourself, I might say, while he was the fallen group at Yale. And these are the people in Bush's mind who kind of think they're better than other folks, think they're smarter than other folks, don't have the common touch, that kind of thing.
Could I just ask you another thing about this episcopacy that's fascinated me for a long time? When you read, something like Elizabeth Mitchell's book, but a lot of even the life of his father, this is not about... service, as Elliot Richard used to say, or brains, or kind of an inherited debt to sort of the managerial, the public management, and enlightened noblesse oblige kind of thing. What they seem to honor much more is money, for one thing, war records, a certain kind of toughness. Who is the god of this episcopacy, is my question.
Yeah, that's interesting. The best book about it, I think, is a book that came out about 10 years ago by Nelson Aldrich, himself a member, called Old Money. And he gets into the sort of obsession with war and competition and so on. I do think...
And Maine real estate, yeah.
Yeah, I do think that these people are sincere in their own minds in thinking of themselves as... devotees of public service, and that allows them, they're so sure about it that it allows them to do various things. The gods would be, these are, you know, people passed from the scene. Henry Stimson, probably number one, the former secretary of everything,
right,
in mid-century years. He's sort of the perfect ideal. It sounds like an obscure figure, but he actually wasn't in this world. Endicott Peabody, who was the headmaster and founder of the Groton School, a very small but very influential boarding school. Those would be, you know.
I hear you. I would just beg to differ, though. It seems to me, I mean, McGeorge Bundy came out of the Stimson world, Elliot Richardson. It seems to me these Bushes are something else. They're nothing like as intellectual. They brag about not reading books or not finishing them. There's another quality about those folk, but we'll come back to it.
Yeah, I know what you mean, although I do think that they have picked up on the rhetoric of public service. They talk about that all the time, and I think they really believe it. I think when George Bush, you know, he wakes up at 3 in the morning and thinks, who am I? He thinks, I am a public servant.
Well, I wonder. Well, we're going to argue that a while, Nick Lemon. 1-800-423-8255 makes the W connection. Jim is in his car in Virginia. Hello, Jim.
Yes, Christopher.
Welcome. Good.
Thank you for the program. I'm enjoying it.
Thank you.
One question that I have, though, and I guess it's a concern, is there seems to be a bit of a rejection on your part of the possibility of what your speaker, your most recent speaker, just stated, that you know, someone can see and know where they come from, but take it in and select and become something else that doesn't reflect what they feel to be negative in their past or in their background. Your comment you just made just before I came on about, you know, they brag about not finishing books. You know, we don't sit with them and watch what happens with books. But he may very well choose not to be perceived, and he may, in fact, not be an intellectual. He has come from a background, but he has looked at what he sees and sees himself as something that has evolved. And I don't think I'd find a problem with that. I believe I see people in the past, in my own life that I've seen, who came from paths similar in families like that, who have become other people.
We're not giving him room to change, you mean?
Pardon me?
You say we're not giving him room to change.
Yes, and typically I think you do a very good job of being objective about that, but I think you seem to be a little more involved in this morning and denying, I think you said earlier, I won't release him from that, or I won't forgive him for allowing him to not acknowledge his, I think you said, snobbiness or something.
To me, the big puzzle about George W. is why he's at war, it seems to me, with where he comes from. Do you know what I mean?
I don't think he is at war with it. I don't agree with that.
The other thing I think that is going on is that I would not underestimate the impact of spending ages 2 to 15 down in West Texas, because while Midland, Texas was having its boom, it's still, when you're down there, comes across as a very middle class to working class town. I mean, more middle class these days, but back then, you know, when they first moved in, they were two doors down from a house that had a dirt yard and you know, chickens and goats out front, and the town was really built by his father and his father's friends in terms of bringing all the kinds of amenities down there. So he, even though he had a place to go to in the summer, you know, they'd spend August in Kennebunkport, and he knew that his grandfather was a senator, and, you know, you'd go to his house and there were finger bowls on the table. Still, that was a small percentage of the time that he of his childhood spent in those rarefied worlds. So I think that what it is it's a kind of, he has a loyalty to those childhood friends and that whole world down there that he can't really forsake.
I want to break in and disagree with Elizabeth. Again, I would say there's something to that, but, you know, America's a really big, complicated country with many elites, and George Bush is very comfortable in the Texas elite, which is quite different from, say, the Boston elite. Yeah, he's a member of that world. He's a man who's totally comfortable in a crowd at a country club in Houston or Dallas. He doesn't think, oh my gosh, I'm a poor country boy thrown among these people. Who he's uncomfortable with is the kind of Northeast liberal intellectual stripe of elite.
Definitely.
And that he does not like those people, and they don't like him. But if you put him in a room of rich businessmen in Texas or anywhere else, I don't think he feels uncomfortable at all.
Stand by for callers.
Neither does Bill Clinton. You know what I mean? That's the one thing. A politician, to get to where they are, basically has to feel quite comfortable in those circles, and I think Bill Clinton would probably be the same way.
Elizabeth, stand by for callers, will you? 1-800-423-8255. Cecile is on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Cecile.
Hi. Yeah, just to make another contrast, I guess, between our northeastern standards and what must be the standards down in Texas, I'm one of those people who, like you, Chris, believes that the more one listens to him, the less one knows what he stands for, or the less.
That wasn't my line, but go ahead.
Well, the less one learns. I mean, I watched an interview with Jim Lehrer, I think it was last night, and I came away not feeling that I had understood a word of anything. And yet I remember back when I first heard that he was possibly going to run for this office, and hearing all these good favorable things about how he was working out as governor of Texas, and people were saying, you know, very impressive and so on. I was a little bit puzzled. But then reading Nick Lemon's article in the New Yorker, I realized that being governor of Texas is nothing near what we think of as the high office here in Massachusetts, that the governor of Texas actually has very little to do, because that's the way the state constitution was designed.
Wayne Slater, is that fair? That it's a very empty office?
Yeah, absolutely. Like many southern states since the Civil War, it is a relatively powerless office, but the governor has certain powers, and he's used those powers. Let me get back to a point. In Texas, since I'm the one sitting in Texas at the moment and have lived here for years, in Texas, you don't have to be intellectual to be smart. Smart is more about being shrewd, and whether it's good or bad, success is often measured by the money you make. And so, as Elizabeth said, and actually as Nicholas mentioned, when he gets together with his friends in Midland, Texas, many business people, many people of substantial wealth, he feels comfortable because these people are smart. They are smart. George Bush is not dumb, but he is not intellectual. He doesn't project himself as an intellectual, but he is a person who understands that if you're quick on the uptake, if you're a quick study, if you're a person who can move quickly in a business opportunity, those are the things that are accrue to success in a place like Texas.
Wayne Slater,
those are the things that accrue to intelligence.
I want to ask you a different question.
Yeah, I just totally agree with that. Speaking as a former Texan myself, that's absolutely on the money. The standards are just different down there, and it's not about being smart or dumb.
I want to ask Wayne a different question about change. You watched George W. Bush in New Hampshire, where he took a header and has come back. What's he going through in his life right now, in his early mid-50s, in this ordeal of a presidential campaign?
Well, I think, I was in New Hampshire the night of the debacle, and then the next morning talked with the governor. He was shell-shocked, and he is still shell-shocked for three or four reasons. But he, frankly, is now scrambling for his life. I think he understands what's at stake here, and he doesn't realize for all his life, everything has gone so right. Everything that, like Elizabeth talks about, the timing has been so good. And frankly, Christopher, if in fact he survives this primary and the next few primaries and becomes the nominee and shows himself to be a fighter who can come back, then he will have demonstrated an element in his character, or at least the public aspect of his character, that he had never shown before. The timing may have been absolutely perfect, but he is on the ropes right now. He is insecure right now. He doesn't look like it when he talks. And when he appears, as the caller mentioned, on something like the interview the other night, he appears, you see that aspect of his insecurity, which seems to diminish him on a television camera. It's funny, if you see him in person with a crowd, that's not the same guy you see.
Hmm. Interesting. Nick Lemon, do you want to comment on that? Or Elizabeth
Mitchell?
Yeah, there's
one thing I disagree with, which is the idea that everything in his life has gone so right. I don't think that's true. And I think to understand George Bush, you have to understand him in almost the opposite way, which is nothing in his life went right until he was pretty well into his 40s and he put together this Texas Rangers deal. That was, what, 89? So I guess he was 43. Up until that point, there wasn't a lot you could point to that had gone right. So I suspect this is a very tough...
His marriage seems to have gone right.
His what?
I say his marriage seems to have gone
right. His marriage seems to have gone right. I've never met his wife, but everyone says she's wonderful. But even there, you have to remember that both of them, by the standards of West Texas, married extremely late. That is, they were both 30. Which by the standards of New York would be child bride, but not in West Texas. And Laura Bush has this quote she gives, which is quite poignant, where she says, you know, we both met, I mean, it makes it sound like that movie where Michelle Pfeiffer is the waitress. You know, we both met, we were like lonely people who had been single all our lives. It wasn't this sort of feeling of the triumphant wedding like JFK and Jackie.
Interesting. Stand by for callers. 1-800-423-8255 is the W Connection phone. Zig is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Zig.
As usual, a wonderful show.
Thank you.
I like this area you're going in, the personal, and I actually had a little something to add to that, but I wanted to actually talk politics because it seems to me that I'm trying to figure out this guy. How is it that he so quickly got $60 million and the establishment's anointment as front runner? I wonder, is it possible that he doesn't really have to be a quick study, he doesn't have to be an intellectual, but that he is a pretty smooth front man for the business lobbies? And the history of his time in Texas might...
It's a good question.
Be the issue.
I want Wayne Slater to answer the money question. And Nick Lemon, would you just testify a little bit to the man's charm in the presence of the man, even with people like you that he's not supposed to like? But first, Wayne Slater, how did he pull this money together?
Well, very quickly, two elements I think were most important. One is that among Republicans about 2 years ago, the word went out even before then that this is the guy who is electable. This is a guy who will win, who can win the nomination. And so a lot of people who have money decided to get on that train and to support him. And the more people got on, the more their rich friends got on. And that's basically how he did it. But more important than that was the word went out that he's not only electable, he's our kind of guy. He's a Republican. Of course, he represents business interests in many ways. The interests who fund campaigns and certainly have the ability to produce, in this case, more than $73 million, is where the war chest will stand at the end of this, I guess, next week, are the kinds of people who are very comfortable with the kind of person George Bush is, representing business interests and not rattling the boat.
Nick Lemon, what's the charm factor here? And tell us about it. Sketch it. I mean, he's famous, for example, for coming up with nicknames for everybody in his circle. How does this work? Where does it come from?
I have to say that I personally didn't find the nickname thing all that charming. Because
what was yours, or did you get one?
My nickname was Nicky, and I actually, not unbeknownst to Governor Bush, have spent my entire life from about the age of 3 living in terror that anyone would call me Nicky. But he kind of establishes a joshing, amiable relationship with everybody, a kind of one-on-one relationship. The whole vibe is, let's cut all this serious, somber stuff and just be real and fun with each other. And he's fun, and if you sort of accept those terms, he's fun to be with. You know, he's got a joke, he winks at you, he loves to talk about baseball. He's good at one-to-one in that particular way. And one of the reasons he did so well up to this point is he was in this world of, you know, one-to-one politics. He was raising money from people. People were being brought down for one-on-one meetings and he would win them over. Now he's in what we call, I guess, wholesale politics or something.
Right.
And he's just not as good at that.
I wonder, Wayne Fitter, how big a factor of success in Texas is that, in a word or two?
You mean the Amy
Just that
campaign?
Wink, yeah.
It was crucial. It was absolutely important.
Listen,
and
we're going to have to come back to this, certainly if he survives the South Carolina primary. But thanks, in any event, to Wayne Slater, Nick Lemon, and our biographer, Elizabeth Mitchell. Her book is called W, Revenge of the Bush Dynasty. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. For The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Delta Dental Plan of Massachusetts, encouraging listeners to see their dentist regularly. It's good for teeth and overall health. 1-800-DELTA-US.